May it please the court. My name is Paul Loney. I represent the appellant Lanny Cervo in this matter. As I stated in my brief, there are two issues on appeal in this matter. We're asking the court to send this case back to district court with instructions to the judge to make a record. First, to make a record of why he denied the motion to view the affidavit. There is nothing in the record at all which states why he denied it, just a simple one-sentence order of denial. And with that, the judge ended the case before we had an opportunity to object. The judge ordered up discovery on his own, and we thought we'd have the ability to argue after he ordered the discovery under seal and for in-camera review. We had no opportunity to even object to that portion of it. He did it on his own. It had to come to him. And we thought he'd give us an opportunity to brief after he had reviewed the documents in camera, which he did not. There was no oral argument on that matter, no argument on any matter in this case at all. The judge just prematurely ended the case by denying us our opportunity to get discovery on this matter.
And going back to your first statement, Mr. Loney, you said that the court gave no reason for his statement, the motion to plaintiff's motion to view the affidavit is denied. Would you comment on pages 5 and 6 of the court's opinion and explain why that is not an explanation of the two conclusions the court reached, one of which is the motion to deny the affidavit?
One moment here.
It's on ER 5 and 6.
Okay.
5, 6, and 7.
Well, again, in here, it looks like he's talking more in here in his opinion that the motion for summary judgment. The judge combined the two decisions on the two issues, the motion for summary judgment and his denial of the motion to view the affidavit in one ruling here.
I know it's one thing to disagree with the court's reasoning, but it's another thing to say that the court gave no reason. He did state, did he not, on page 6 on the ER, the real conflict in this case appears to arise from the plaintiff's failure to itemize remaining property, blah, blah, blah. That sentence. And the discussion that followed that and the discussion that preceded that, could not that not be reasons, however truncated and however you may not agree with, is at least a statement of reason, sir.
Well, it may be a statement, but I believe if it is a statement, it would be a clear abuse of discretion. It's abuse of discretion. It's basically when there's an Oregon Natural Resources Council versus Marsh and United versus Smith, the record contains no evidence to support the decision. It's a clear use of discretion. And however, if it applies another one, that correct law to the facts, that it may abuse discretion if it rules in an irrational manner.
Now, at the time the court made this decision, was not the due process violation you are asserting is that the authorities were keeping the items seized in the search too long, that they had neglected to return everything that was seized. Is that not the basic issue that was before the court on the due process at that time? On the due process issue?
Yes, on the due process claim. However, we had the other motion, we had the motion to review the affidavit, which he ruled in the same document. And that motion to review affidavit, I believe if we were granted, that would have given us new evidence in order to ask him to reconsider his earlier decision, throwing out most of the claims, and to show that there was a due process violation when they raided my client's business and home and seized all kinds of property.
You are saying that at that time, that issue was still alive?
At the motion of affidavit, it was never briefed by anybody. It was never argued. It was never requested. We never had a formal motion in front of the judge until the time that that motion was submitted. And I believe that if we'd have been granted, we could have come up with new evidence.
Well, I guess correct me on the procedure. It seems to me that you made a 42-1 request for the return of property seized. Is that right?
But that was made by a previous attorney earlier in the case before this civil rights case was even filed. Because at the time, and that was after my client was never arrested in this case, nobody was ever arrested, nobody was ever charged with anything, nobody was ever convicted, and it just became obvious that the government made a bad mistake.
All right. Well, I'm thoroughly confused, sir. It seems to me that the record, as I read it, was that this motion for the return of the matter seized was paramount to this case.
Well, not everything was returned at the time.
And that was your argument. You made the motion to return. They didn't return all of it.
And again, if I may, the Bivens violation occurred when they actually raided my client's residence and business. That's when, and even the return of the property could not cure that violation. I hope that was clear in my brief. If not, I'm going to make it clear now. That's when the violation occurred. And no matter what happened, the return of property, that's not going to cure the violation. And again, if I may continue on, again, we would ask for a civil version of Frank's hearing, mailed to controvert the affidavit. That was never allowed to us. We believe that there's deliberately and recklessly false statements in the affidavit submitted to the magistrate to issue the search warrant, and that was material to the magistrate finding probable cause.
What could be materially false when the search was for pornography that was produced at your client's location, and in fact that's what was found? So why should we assume, or why is it even plausible to think that the affidavit was false?
Well, I believe that the affidavit deliberately confused my client's business and place of residence, much as the government's brief and this appeal does. They combine the two when there's almost no connection between the two other than the fact that my client had a business and my client had a residence. And my client was never in possession of that pornography that was found, and the government
knew
that.
Well, okay. I guess that's your assertion that they already knew that.
They talked to one of my client's employees who told them that. My client's employees were asked by government agents to, if they would offer rewards to come up with statements about my client's illegal activities, and there were none. And I believe that there was, and again, the government claims that they're in their brief as lurid allegations that my client has a long history with the Portland Police Bureau. And Portland Police Bureau was not happy with him, and we believe that either there was a police officer who was the third person mentioned in the affidavit or an informant that deliberately misled Agent Sparrow of the FBI. And Agent Sparrow failed to do her job to see whether or not this was actually occurring, especially in my client's residence. The one Portland police officer, his affidavit stated that he talked to a gentleman's probation officer, and he knew that gentleman was not staying at my client's place of residence other than on his couch sleeping with some clothes there. There was nothing there. And that this case is much like the Green Street case, which I mentioned in my brief, where the government raided a person's business and residence there, and they found there was one person who had a record that connected the two. And it kind of was here. Somebody spent a few nights at my client's residence who had a criminal record. And the government made up this long unbelievable story, and they got the magistrate to sign off on it.
Counsel, your time has expired. Thank you. Mr. Silver?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, I have a kind of an underlying question.
Certainly.
I don't understand from what we have in front of us why these affidavits were ever sealed in the first place. The record, at least as I have looked at it, doesn't really explain that.
Your Honor, I would have to agree with you. The record that's made it into this court is not very complete. In the defendant's supplemental excerpt of records, we tried to add more,
but do you agree with me that there's no adequate explanation of why initially the affidavits were sealed for us to understand what the reasoning was?
I think it can be inferred in that the original affidavits were part of the criminal investigation. They were sealed as part of the criminal investigation. They involved minors and the identity of minors. And I think that can be fairly easily inferred from what is before the court. The history of why they remain sealed and the courts, Judge Haggerty, viewing them under in camera, under seal, I don't think there's a lot in this record.
Well, isn't it, in general, the government's burden to demonstrate why an affidavit it is to remain sealed vis-a-vis the person whose property is to be searched?
I think that's a fair statement, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, and if we don't have any adequate explanation of the sealing, and it's the government's burden, why then shouldn't we order the affidavits to be unsealed and to allow the plaintiff to make whatever arguments he can from those affidavits?
Well, I think it would be a terrible mistake for this court on this record to order these affidavits unsealed.
Well, what about ordering further proceedings to show cause why they shouldn't be unsealed? Because just speaking for myself, I don't see the justification for the sealing.
And I would have to say, Your Honor, that the appellant and the plaintiff just didn't bring that to this court. That's not what they brought to this court. What they brought to this court and the record they're asking you to rule on is, at the time, as Judge Aldershot was discussing, at the time that Judge Haggerty ruled on this motion to unseal the affidavit and view the affidavit, the only remaining issue in the case was, did Adrian Sparrow and the other three FBI agents hold on to these computer documents too long?
That's true, but it seems like a chicken and egg problem, because the reason that was the only remaining issue was that the rest of the case had already been thrown out because they couldn't make the case because they couldn't see the affidavit. And so it seems somehow inappropriate to then say, aha, I've already ruled, so now it's too late for you to support the thing that I've already ruled on.
Well, Your Honor, I appreciate your frustration, and had the appellant brought the entire case to this court, then we would have had filed the affidavits under seal with this court, just as I had done it with the district court.
We have them under seal in this court.
The court does have the,
yes,
the affidavits. Okay. Well, I think if they are viewed, and even the plaintiff in one of his, Mr. Loney, in one of his affidavits, said that the affidavit was facially valid. In terms of what was necessary for this court, let me back up for a second. In terms of what this court needs to rule on what this appellant has brought to this Court of Appeals, I believe that you have everything you need. Namely, was Judge Haggerty abusing his discretion when, on trying to rule on a property Fifth Amendment due process claim, did the plaintiff need to see the affidavit that underlie the original police action? And the answer is no, it was not an abuse of discretion. That is what the appellant has brought into this courthouse.
So you're relying essentially on what you believe has been waived.
That's correct. Had the other issue been here, we could have briefed it, argued it, and discussed it, and appellant really did not bring that forth to this court. And Judge Haggerty, in his decision, back when he was ruling on, when the judge was ruling on the defendant's second motion to dismiss in summary judgment, the one that resulted in the August 17th decision, Judge Hagerty went through at length how all of the assertions that the plaintiff was making, even assuming they were true, did not invalidate the warrant, did not show bad faith, and did not deprive the FBI agents of qualified immunity. And so what I would ask is, if you, the court will go back to Judge Hagerty's decision of August, I think it's August 17th, 2001, if you go back, Judge Hagerty goes through at great length of why, even accepting the plaintiff's assertions, it doesn't invalidate the warrant, it doesn't show the bad faith, and qualified immunity is appropriate, and there just is no need to unseal these affidavits.
Trust me, I'm from the government. That's really what you're saying to the plaintiff.
No.
That's, I think, the reason why, in general, the government bears the burden to demonstrate that an affidavit should be sealed, is that the object of the search should have the opportunity to test those things and to have a dialogue with the judge about those things.
And I appreciate that. I will also say that after I made my motion for summary judgment, where the affidavit was going to be a major focus of that motion, neither side asked for oral argument in front of the court. Neither side asked for this modified Franks hearing that Mr. Loney's describing. That was there was never a request for that. And with all due respect, I think it would be inappropriate for this court to say to Judge Hagerty, you did something wrong that actually no one really appealed. And it's his reasoning is all there. And it's not Judge Hagerty saying, I accept the government saying, we're the government, we tell the truth. It's him reviewing the affidavit under seal, him reviewing the exhibits that went with it, all of the pornography, as Your Honor described. What certainly makes this different from the Green Street case is they found the child pornography at the Rage. They found the child pornography at Mr. Fulmo's residence. And it's very important, and my lights will sum up. And so to sum up, what I would say is it's really critical to remember this was about a search warrant, not an arrest warrant. This was not about an arrest warrant for Mr. Loney. It was about a search warrant looking for evidence of child pornography. They found the child pornography. And the agents did not violate Mr. Swerdlow's constitutional rights when executing a facially valid search warrant. And the last point I want to make is, I think it is particularly disturbing that the appellant and the plaintiff never was prepared to distinguish between these four FBI agents. All the way through to the very end, even when it was just about this property that was sitting in a locker over at the FBI headquarters under the control of Adrian Sparrow, he insists on continuing to sue the other three agents who just came along to help execute the search warrant. So that's what I have to say in summary here.
Can you tell me where in the district court's order he addresses the affidavits issue?
I believe it's in the 917th decision. I have to look at my excerpt of records.
I believe he starts on excerpt 68.
Probably in the qualified immunity section. So I'm going to say generically it is going to be probably pages 75 through 78.
And 68 also.
Particularly page 77 where the court says, accepting all of the plaintiff's factual allegations as true, the plaintiff's argument fails. And he goes on from there to list why.
Right, and one thing he says is after examining the affidavit, it's clear that the affidavit supports the finding of probable cause, and that's the place that is of concern to me is why, How can the plaintiff be expected to argue against that without seeing the affidavit?
Well, all I can say, Your Honor, is that there have been, it's been the procedure for I don't know how many years, that a court may view an affidavit under seal and decide whether it should be reviewed or not released. And I just don't think that was truly preserved for this court and the record brought before this court to really trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case just argued is submitted.